Our final presentation in this section today is a partnership for preservation. UCLA and the Lou Curtis San Diego Folk Festival Collection, presented today by Aaron Biddle. I'll just list them in order here. Aaron Biddle serves as archivist, librarian, and head of digital projects for the UCLA Ethnomusicology Archive, where his duties include grant writing and management, as well as community relations. He is also an active musician with a professional and academic background, both in ethnomusicology and music education, including studies in Bulgarian and Irish music. Lou Curtis, the namesake of the collection, is a folklorist and musicologist steeped in knowledge of the history of American traditional music. He is widely known as an expert in his field. Besides organizing 33 major folk festivals in San Diego, he has operated his record store, Folk Arts Rare Records, for the past 40 years. For the past 20 years, he has hosted a weekly radio show called Jazz Roots, broadcast over KSDS Radio, one of the preeminent jazz radio stations in the Western United States. Mr. Curtis is himself a recipient of a 1985 NARA Grammy Award for producing the record Steamboat Whistle Blues, a reissue of Roy Acuff recordings from 1936 to 1939 for Rounder Records. His collection of thousands of tapes includes many hundreds of reels from the San Diego Folk Festivals, which began in 1967, as well as from performances at several other local San Diego venues. Finally, Russ Hamm has been working with Lou Curtis for the past 4 years to digitally preserve the music, which is a unique record of American roots music as it lived and flourished in Southern California during the last four decades of the 20th century. He is an educational technology specialist for a local school district. His personal interest includes folk music and goes back to over 40 years. Let's welcome them.
Thank you. Just get this set up. Any of you were here last year at last year's ARSCA, not here in Washington, but in Palo Alto, and were at the pre-conference on grant writing and funding opportunities, you'll remember that one of the things that came up quite frequently, excuse me, I'll try to multitask. One of the points that was made quite frequently was that in this day and age, granting agencies are looking for partnerships, collaborations between institutions, collaborations between individuals and institutions. And so that struck a chord in my mind because we had been working on a partnership project with the Lou Curtis Collection. And I think it's a really nice success story of the win-win situation that you can get with these collaborations. And so we'd like to present about that today. The first part of the presentation will discuss how the partnership was set up, the elements, what each group brought to the table, and what we've taken from it. And then we'll spend some time exploring the many riches in the Lou Curtis Collection, both the things that have been digitized so far and the things that we're hoping to get to soon in the future. So is this... There we go. I've got to switch screens. Oops. That's why. All right. So the first section will talk a bit about the collaborative grant and where the idea came from. I actually was not at UCLA when this started. It was my predecessor's archivist, John Vallier, who went down to San Diego. And I think I'll let Russ and Lou tell this story because they were actually there.
Yeah, you guys have to step up. You have the loud mic.
We started out by calling some of our local universities, and we didn't get much interest from local universities. So our next phone call was actually to the Library of Congress, where we got lots of interest. And from the Library of Congress, we talked to a couple of people, and they directed us right away to a guy named David Soibert at UC Santa Barbara as kind of an expert on this kind of process on the West Coast. And he, in turn, put us in touch with UCLA. And then John came down to visit you.
John came down to visit me and looked over the tape collection that I have, and we went from there.
This was the first time that the UCLA Ethnomusicology Archive had done this sort of collaborative grant project, but it's really become a nice model for us. We've since engaged in collaborations with other individuals and groups doing preservation grants, particularly people applying through the Grammy Foundation, because we're very familiar with that. And as I mentioned before, I think it's a nice model for one way that institutions that don't necessarily have a lot of financial resources but might have expertise and facilities can partner with individuals and community organizations that have these great collections that need to be preserved. So the people involved, again, the UCLA Ethnomusicology Archive, were one of the largest ethnographic collections in the country. And until fairly recently, we did not collect American, U.S.-based folk music until around 2000, when we acquired the former UCLA Folklore and Mythology Archives, which were founded and maintained by D.K. Wilgus, who had passed away suddenly about a decade prior. And when the Folklore and Mythology program was dissolved, that archive was very suddenly shifted over to the Ethnomusicology Archive. And that was our first major holding in U.S.-based folk music. Since then, we've brought in the Curtis collection, the part that we have so far, and that's attracted other collections. As a state, part of a state institution, one of our mandates is to do a certain amount of public service to interface with the community, and in our case, that's interfacing with individual collectors and communities that have these community members who have these really important recordings. Since we're a state institution and we can't charge for our services, that makes us the world's cheapest consultants, which is a real, it's a good deal in
good
a lot of ways.
Good benefit to us.
On the other side, I suppose Russ and Lou can tell you a bit about the San Diego Folk Heritage Foundation. Is that?
Well, the San Diego Folk Heritage Group was an organization that was organized just to do concerts in San Diego of traditional music and folk music of various kinds. And they had that all-important thing that we needed, nonprofit status in the state of California immediately. And so when we were looking to put together the proposal to the Grammy people, we said, can we use your nonprofit status? And they said, sure, and that's about the way it went.
We also had a partnership with the Library of Congress. They're serving as consultants, and also they're going to be a secondary repository of the digital files as we produce them. So our project, in a nutshell, was to take the first 400 of these tapes over a two-year period, digitize them, ship everything to UCLA and to Library of Congress.
And that's pretty much done at this point, and they're probably 1,500 to 2,000 more reels of material that we need to digitalize and put into the project. And the question is how to do it.
Other than the fact that granting agencies are really looking for partnerships these days, there were some compelling reasons for us to be in this partnership for this project. From Lou and Russ's side, you have this really rich, fantastic collection that spans a fairly long period of time, 20, almost 30 years.
Well, some of the earliest tapes in the library go back to the 1950s.
Okay.
And the latest ones are from 2 or 3 years ago, so it's quite an extensive period.
And we have the advantage that's very rare in archival collections in having a huge amount of expertise and both written documentation and particularly living documentation in Lou and his arranging of the San Diego Folk Festivals and his really in-depth knowledge of the folk scene in Southern California. So that was a really rare opportunity, and just the interest and passion of these guys with the collection. It's not the sort of thing that you get when you get a few boxes of tapes that were in somebody's garage that said, oh, you know, Dad thought these were really important. We don't know what to do with them. On the UCLA side, we have the technical expertise. We were able to serve officially in the Grammy Grant as technical consultants. We wrote a letter of support and a letter of commitment. We have the UCLA Digital Library, which is well regarded and was able to provide the necessary digital repository storage and preservation was required for the grant. But, of course, we didn't have any money, and that was these guys wrote the grant, and that was where the money came from. So the basic setup of the project, the tapes stayed with Russ and Lou. They digitized them. I think you probably discussed how this would work out with
right.
John, but ultimately
yeah, right.
we decided it was best to digitize on-site first.
Right.
And those of you who know Southern California, even though San Diego and Los Angeles aren't that far apart on a map, it can be pretty difficult to get back and forth. So we decided it was best to digitize and then send the tapes. So that meant that I think John made a trip or two down to get you guys set up, consult on technical specifications and procedures, and to make sure that everything was done
I went up there
according
a couple
to
of time,
and you came up to UCLA.
UCLA.
Right. After that, as the tapes were digitized, they were shipped to UCLA. We physically we did the archival processing. We had this process of co-creating the descriptive finding aid. Russ would enter the original information, and we would augment that with our processing information, box location, preservation copies, and so on. And then all of the preservation masters as well as the original masters were stored in UCLA's storage library and special collections storage facility, which has a climate-controlled, secure special collections floor.
But I've got to add that the information comes from Lou, because even though he has a pretty extensive typed catalog of his tapes, he has a memory of a lot of the information in great detail. So we're able to capture that.
Yeah. For the actual proposal, again, as in this case, because of the way the Grammy grants were structured, UCLA wasn't a partner officially, but we were a technical consultant, which worked out fairly well. We didn't actually receive the money, but we were able to provide technical support and the level of assurance that there'd be supervision of quality in the digitization process, that it would be a secure, stable environment for the both the original masters and the preservation copies. We were also, before the grant was approved, as I recall, it was sent back for some clarification on exactly how the digital preservation process would be managed, and particularly with regards to the digital files in preservation repository storage. And so the head of our digital library, Stephen Davison, was able to write a letter clarifying that satisfied the Grammy Foundation and allowed the project to go forward. So some of the outcomes of the project. We've been able to preserve these wonderful recordings, 420 of them so far with the original grant. We're looking for more funding sources to preserve more of them. There are two access points, a physical access point in the archive and an online access point, which at this point is only on the UCLA campus because of rights issues. However, we're hoping to do some more research into the rights to clear up some of the recordings that may be able to be made available on the open internet. It's also raised awareness because of this collaboration of these materials, the project, the archive, and as I mentioned before, it's brought in other related collections, so that at this point, where a decade ago the Ethnomusicology Archive really didn't have significant collections in U.S.-based folk music, now it's one of our strongest collecting areas. one of the things that we did, UCLA Ethnomusicology Department hosted a 50th anniversary celebration of the Ash Grove last spring, and the archive held an open house as part of that, and we were playing recordings from this collection, particularly from the San Diego Folk Festivals, and we knew that that would bring back some memories from some of the people attending the Ash Grove, and we were able to get in a little bit of publicity about both the collection and the grant and some of our other work. And I think we haven't heard anything directly. We heard a lot of positive comments on that day. We haven't heard anything directly yet, but we're kind of hoping that word is going around about these things. And one note that I wanted to bring up about our methodology with regards to data. Because the Ethnomusicology Archive itself does not have a digital mass storage system, we rely on the UCLA Digital Library and their infrastructure, and they've been very generous in that regard. But we, for the purposes of this grant, we decided to use archival data DVDs as an intermediary format. We did this for several reasons. One was that the time lag with getting the files into the digital repository was fairly long. We've finished this project last one, and the digital files are now just starting to make it into the repository. So in the meantime, we have a backup preservation set on DVD, and those are stored in safe storage in the same site with the originals, and then another set of those DVDs will be stored at the Library of Congress. It had been suggested to ship hard drives back and forth. Again, that would have been difficult with the time lag with the digital library, but we also felt that while DVDs, archival DVDs and CDs are not a great preservation medium by any stretch of the imagination, they were much more stable than a hard drive sitting on a shelf, particularly since we were using them as a backup copy. So for the rest of the presentation, this is going to be a bit of show and tell about the Curtis Collection, and I think we'll probably just scratch the surface of what's in there, but these guys will be available at least for the rest of the day for those of you who'd like to ask questions about it. And I think I'll mostly turn this over to you. You're the experts, and I think I'm going to learn about this as well. I've actually met them in person for the first time last night, and they've been regaling me with all sorts of amazing stories of all the people who are involved in this collection and the performances and festivals. A little bit about the history of the collection.
Here, that's picture.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Believe it or not, that's me sitting there with hair. And let's see, who is the four other people with me? There are people from KPBS, I think, the local public radio station. There was one festival we did where we broadcast the entire festival on a 8 or 9 state hookup, where all the western states got the festival.
That's
a concert going on in the background there. I think that it's Curtis Bowders from Tennessee.
And Lou, how did you, what was the beginning of this collection? Did it start with the first folk festival?
Oh, it probably started with my first tape recorder back when I was in high school in the 50s. And I got a tape recorder and started taking it around to coffee houses.
And I should mention that the San Diego Folk Festival collection and the related materials, which we'll talk about in just a moment, are only a small part of the Lou Curtis Sound Library, which I think you said has about 90,000 hours of material including
right.
Commercial recordings as well as these concert and field recordings. So what started that, couldn't resist putting together a cute little animation, but what started with Lou's personal collection
right.
has kept growing and growing.
And over the years, we've added. Most recently, we got 50 tapes from Sam Hinton, the folk singer, and some of those go back to the early 50s. a bunch of West Coast tapes from various archives, people like Reverend Gary Davis, and I've got about 6 hours of Bessie Jones from the Georgia Sea Islands, and a lot of other people. The first festival was in 1967, and we had $350 budget, and we spent $250 of it on Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys.
And his bus broke down.
And his bus broke down, and the Dillards came down and backed him up. So the other 250, well, there's a poster coming up, I think, here.
Yeah, that's in a couple of shots. Let's see. That's over here, that's from the first.
It's the first festival in 1967.
One of the stories that you guys told me the other day when we were talking about this collection was how it was moved, actually with the whole record store, it was moved very suddenly a few years ago.
4 years ago, we had to move my record store that had been in business. We've been in business 43 years, and we had been at the same place for 27 years, and you accumulate a lot of stuff. Particularly when you're dealing with old 78s and 33s and 45s and what have you. We moved about 8 tons of records, along with another couple of tons of tapes, I guess.
And I think that turned out to be a perfect early step to this project, because it was part of the move. I think the very wisely organized and labeled everything. I imagine that makes it much easier on your end.
Right.
And when they come to us, they're already very well labeled and organized again. Makes my job as an archivist much, much easier. So we've been talking a bit about the collection contents. The bulk of the collection is the San Diego Folk Festivals, which ran from 67 through 87, and the later Adams Street Roots Festival.
Adams Roots Festival. That started in 94, and it's... I was involved with it up until about 2 years ago.
And along with all the great performances that are in these festivals, there are quite a number of workshops. In fact, if you look closely, I pulled the tape at random out of the box to scan for this the other day, and if you look closely under the Cajun Workshop, there's a familiar name there at the end. I don't know if he said Dick here, and guess not. Okay. But I thought that was an appropriate one to show. Mm-hmm. So we'll play some sound clips. This is Sam Hinton talking about pocket instruments.
Well, I don't know what we're supposed to do in a workshop on this kind of music, except to say that I've interpreted this idea of pocket instruments as being instruments that are not to be taken very seriously. And this includes all sorts of things that are serious instruments, like harmonicas and penny whistles and other things that are less so. But I don't know how to go about this, especially in the light of the fact that we don't have a microphone for you to hear with, and a lot of these instruments are very, very soft. Let's just try an experiment. Mr. and Mrs. Sorensen brought an instrument that I forgot to bring. This is a nice little pocket instrument. Also, I've included as pocket instruments things that you can build yourself, anything that you can make yourself in anything less than 25 minutes I would call a pocket instrument. And this is one of those. This is an extra fancy one, of course. It has a tuning peg and everything like that. This is what Jimmy Driftwood calls a pickin' bow. The word mouth bow is often used, but he said they never called it that in Arkansas. The instrument itself is one of the most ancient of all instruments. There's one school of thought that actually says that the weapon, the bow...
In nice shape. They were nicely made recordings. The tapes have survived well. I think, you know, due in no small part to lose stewardship of the collection. But that really makes it an exceptional collection to work with archivally in yet another way. So we'll do a bit more listening here.
Mo Ash sums it up very well in a sense. He says that really we've got kind of a wrong idea about copyrights. He feels that a person belongs to his country and anything he does belongs to the country. If he does something really original, then the country rewards him by renting what he does for a short time, but eventually it reverts back to the country that this guy lives in. this is true of really individual creation and invention, as well as it is in copyright. So with this sort of an attitude, you get a little further in trying to realize that folk music is kind of a natural resource.
Maybe we should have presented that one at the copyright panel yesterday morning and see how...
That was what my statement was about public domain.
Mo Ash sums it up very well in a...
You know. I hate to butt in. We're going to have to bring his stand to close, but I was going to college, probably is the right word. But my guitar and me are just like one. And I think sometime we come to the point of where that we go overboard, and in order for me to have my thing and all the way I want it, if we're not careful, we step on somebody else's feet doing that.
The greedy ego trip. Yeah.
So who is that?
That was Cliff Carlisle.
All right, and we've got a few pictures and sound clips from concerts, and Russ and Lou, I suppose you could narrate through some of these.
It's a picture of Robert Jeffrey and Sam Chapman. So Robert Jeffrey's a blues pianist locally. He lived in San Diego. He's from Oklahoma. Sam Chapman is from Hollandale, Mississippi. And that's John Jackson. Virginia, and Kenny Hall from Fresno, California.
Say a little bit about Kenny Hall.
Kenny is, if you live in California, you know who Kenny Hall is. He's played every festival in California. He's kind of a master old-timey musician, and a lot of people have followed his kind of unique way of playing the mandolin. Plays fiddle, too. And Otis Pierce. Otis ran a boarding house out on the King River called Pierce's Park, and a lot of the musicians around Fresno played there. Otis was originally from Missouri, and he played old time music and traditional songs, country songs. And that's Utah Phillips and Rosalie Sorrells. Interestingly enough, that picture was taken by Ray Patterson, the old-time mandolin player from Colorado Springs. And he always took pictures at our festivals, and he sent them out to me. They always had his wife in them in the background. So that's her in the middle. That's Ina Patterson, way back in the back there.
I think we have a sound clip with this one as well of Rosalie Sorrells. Okay.
Oh, that's a workshop at the second San Diego Folk Festival, and this is on the left-hand side is Stu Jameson and the Possum Hunters String Band with a fellow named Larry Hanks, the guy with the beard in the middle of them, and Ray and Ina Patterson at the fourth festival. They played. They were sort of, them and along with Kenny Hall were sort of regulars at our festivals, and Ray and I always went out of their way to make any old timers that we were bringing out to the festival feel comfortable. They would take, when we brought Cliff Carlisle, Wilbur Ball, they went up and introduced themselves, and they showed them this is the way it was, this is where the restrooms are, this is everything, just to make them feel good. Plus they played some good music.
And I have a sample of that.
The Automobile of Life. Some people are just like an automobile. They'll run fine when everything's right. When the road is all clear and the weather is fine, with plenty of sunshine.
will prove they never were built to endure.
That's Roscoe Holcomb at the fourth festival. And that's Dave Polachek with him of the Possum Hunter String Band. And the other picture is Sam and Kirk McGee, who were on the Grand Ole Opry back as early as the 20s. And that's Patsy Montana with him, who was a singing cowgirl, made lots of records back in the 30s.
Now this is from one of the later folk festivals from the 9th. How far have we digitized so far? We're up to the ninth now.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of things. I think most of the pictures that we have represented here and all the sounds have already been digitized, but there's a lot more in the coming years.
Yeah, we did. Like I said, we did 20 festivals in all. We did. There's a lot of people coming up that we haven't gotten to yet. Thomas Shaw. Dr. Snootful's Wonder Cure Medicine Show. Yeah, that's the old Hat Band, and their recreation of. They're from Seattle, and they recreated an old time medicine show and brought it down one year to the festival. And Thomas Shaw was a blues singer from Brennan, Texas, who moved out to San Diego, California in 1934 and wandered into my store one day looking for some guitar strings, and he kind of had a bit of a second career as a blues singer in the years that followed. We made two or three albums that you can still buy one or two of them, I think. And that's Utah Phillips, the golden voice of the Great Southwest, acting as an MC at one of the festivals.
A couple of sound clips here.
I went to work for the Millers. That's not Zach Miller. I went for the Little Miller Ranch down in North Texas. I've been working in the Big Bend for a while. And a fella took me out on the front porch. This is by way of introduction to this here cowboy song. And you should understand that in Utah, a cowboy is anybody whose mother was a cow. Old Miller took me out on the porch and put his arm around my shoulder, and he said, "You know, as far as you can see, I own that. My grandfather fought for it. My great-grandfather fought for it. Now I get in my car in the morning, and it takes me 3 days to drive all the way around this ranch." I said, "Yep, had a car like that once myself." "But what are you going to do with a Texian?" "Vain bunch. You can almost tell a Texan. Not much." Songs about the old Goodnight Loving Trail from El Paso to Dolores, Colorado, up to Denver and Cheyenne. It was a way to get beef to the railhead. It wasn't a wet herding trail. You'd only take steers up it because there was no way to handle the new calves. The trail was too rough. A dozen guys used to work it, riding on point out in front, riding on swing along the sides, or riding on drag in the back. Hard job, that's riding the drag, because you got to wear a bandana eating all the trail dust. That's generally the greenhorns in the crew. You got the boss and the wrangler who handles the remuda that travels with the herd, all the horses that move with the trail herd. And you got the old woman. Of course, back then, just like today, the work of a cook was the worst work you could do. And so the term old woman was a derisive term. It was a put-down. And those old leathery, sourdough, irascible cooks, cranky as hell, in the Southwest were called, in the language of that time, called the old woman. But hell, you know, they used to be working cowboys. They used to spend 12 hours in the saddle doing the hardest kind of work there is. You spend that long in the saddle and your insides get mixed up. You can't ride anymore. Well, in this kind of a capitalist system, if you can't do the job you set out to do, then you just go become a bum or you die or you try to find something else to do. Well, these old cowboys used to wind up on the Chuck Gang. And instead of riding into town and hoorahing and shooting the place up and then coming back all drunked up, they got left behind at the fire. And they were the ones who had to have the coffee ready when the boys rode in. And they were the ones that had to use the old Indian curers to doctor their chilblains and saddle sores. And they had to listen to their whines and complaints and handle their bedrolls. So I guess those, what they called old women, had a right to be sore about something. Triangle and curse everything. If dirt was a kingdom, then you'd be the king. On the goodnight trail, on the loving trail, our old woman's lonesome tonight. Your French harp blows like a lone ball in calf. It's a wonder the wind don't tear off your skin. Get in there and blow out the light. With your snake oil and herbs and your liniment too, you can do anything that a doctor can do, except find a cure for your own goddamn stew. On the goodnight trail, on the loving trail, our old woman's lonesome tonight. Your French harp blows like a lone ball in half. It's a wonder the wind don't tear off your skin. Get in there and blow out the light.
I think that's a good place to wrap up and take some questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was, yes. Most of those materials, now as I understand, are at NC State. We have discovered in the what we call the D.K. Wilgus collection, was the former archives of mythology and folklore, we've discovered a few remnants of the Edwards collection.
Don't you wish you had it back?
Yeah. If I could have been there 30 years ago, you know. Mm-hmm. But...
sad story, isn't it?
Yeah. That's, you know, all the more important that we are able to preserve other materials like these.
And don't let it happen to you again.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And I think we're in a much better position now. Yes?
Are most of these tapes in mono or some in stereo? Or do you even
both
start up along yet?
Both of them are... Most of them are in stereo, but some of them are in mono.
Yes?
Could you talk a little more about your recording setup? They sound really amazing.
How were they recorded on site?
Huh?
At the in the concert?
Most of them were recorded on site. We, for from about the third festival on, we usually had somebody there that was recording them for us. There's a fellow named Richard Church who recorded for me for several years, and he would usually just take it right off the board, right off the soundboard.
And
KPBS both contributed tapes along the way of things we didn't get. Sometimes we get the whole festival from them.
And that's another future step for this collection, to start to connect with some of those other organizations, particularly KPFK, the Pacifica Archives, since they have such a well-organized and managed archive. I think we have some good opportunities to cross-reference and make links between those collections to get an overall broader picture of the folk music revival scene in Southern California. Other questions?
Can you talk a little bit about the rights issues and making some
Most of the tapes that we made at the festivals, at the time we made them, we got releases signed by the artists for broadcast. Both KPFK and that was one thing that we kind of always insisted on, that both KPFK and NPR got releases from them to be able to use those tapes.
Well, that's one of our next steps, is to track those written releases down, because we don't have them at the moment, but we're going to see if they still exist, if we can find them, and then I've spoken with the head of our digital library, and we may be able to use that as a bit of an argument for reasonable
fair use
and you know, doing our background checks on copyright and having, you know, something that says, of course, they're aware of the recording, they allowed it, and they allowed it to be distributed over broadcast, and we could perhaps argue that it could be distributed online. At the moment, as I mentioned, these are available in the UCLA, or they're becoming available in the UCLA Digital Library, but only on campus. Hopefully, as we're able to clear up rights issues with particular events or recordings, then we can make selected ones available online. I don't expect that they'll probably all be online. Yes. One more question.
I'd like to comment, first of all, Luke Curtis, on presenting a lot of really interesting vernacular or true folk artists, instead of so many organizations did nothing but quote-unquote folk music, you know, singer-songwriters, da-da-da. He really tried to present all kinds of different ethnic traditions, and so I want to commend him for that, commend him for that. But secondly, how are you ever going to utilize this material in your research archives unless you go through each song and write down keywords, and also in regard to the interviews, which will really only be worthwhile, again, if you have keywords that you can focus on. For example, if somebody wants to know something about Dennis McGee that has not been found prior to this, how can you find this in your...
I've been trying to do that as we went through it. If I found a significant portion of the spoken word part of a workshop, I tried to make a point of including at least a reference to that on the tape.
And that's incorporated. If you remember, part of our process is that the descriptive finding aid, which we do in XML EAD using an online interface developed by our digital library. And so Russ is able to input that remotely. He does that in cooperation with Lou. Russ starts with some really cursory background information. Lou fills everything in from his rich memory. And so a lot of those things are in the finding aid, which eventually will be online and searchable through the Online Archive of California. So as far as the detailed keywords or transcripts of some of the interviews, we really aren't set up to do that. Perhaps if we find something that's really, really essential, we might be able to arrange something through our UCLA's Oral History program.
You can hear a few things by going to my website at folkartsrarerecords.com, and there's tracks from the first four festivals.
afraid that's all the time we have. I'm sure all of our presenters can answer questions later if you have some later.
Sure.